Welcome to Red Eyes Radio. My name is Henrik. It's good to have you with us today. We are here on Thursdays and Sundays doing radio on topics that we consider to be the most important and interesting. The website is redeyescreations.com. Take a look around for news, radio, webcast archives, our member section, and much more. And today we have Edmund Merridge back with us on the program. Edmund has been working with the material of Christian and Barbara Joy O'Brien, who have been writing on the Anunnaki, or Anunnagi, as some say. And last time Edmund was with us, we talked about the origins of agriculture, the origins of this knowledge of how to plant. We talked about the mythology of the Anunnaki, or the Shining Ones, and the genius of the few. And today we're going to talk a little bit more about this. We're going to talk about the Garden of Eden, Karsag, getting to some other sites around the Middle East, Göbekli Tepe as being one in Turkey that has been claimed to be the Garden of Eden. Many people are looking into this right now as well. We're also going to talk a little bit about the Stars and Stones Forum that is upcoming here the 18th and 19th of April in the UK. We're going to talk about some of the speakers and some of the interesting material that will be addressed during this conference. Edmund also runs the website goldenageproject.org, where you can find books, DVDs, articles around these kinds of topics on human history, megalithic sites, the Garden of Eden, ancient technology, even Atlantis, and much, much more. So do check it out. It's the goldenageproject.org. So with that, welcome back to Red Eyes Radio, Edmund, and thank you for coming back on.
Well, thank you, Henrik. It's a great pleasure to be here.
It's very good to have you here again, and I know that we got a great response to the last program that we did back in November, I think it was, and I'm really interested in talking more about this, and I think it would be a good idea just to do a kind of short recap, I guess, on the main thesis that you've been following and researching, and also then picking up on from the work of Christian and Barbara Joy O'Brien, on the Shining Ones, on the Anunnaki, and that will get people kind of up to speed. And from that point, we can go into some of the new areas and some of the stuff that we didn't do last time, Edmund.
Fine. Well, my journey starts with somebody called Christian O'Brien and his wife, Barbara Joy O'Brien, who, in fact, Barbara Joy O'Brien was my mother's first cousin. So I had a leg up, if you like, and a roadmap of time from their incredible research and work. And I followed the trail and asked all the questions of Christian O'Brien about my particular interest, which was the origin of agriculture, when I realized that agriculture was pretty much unchanged for many thousands of years, and that in the area where I lived in the Cotswolds, all the basic crops and domesticated animals were in place with enclosures, walled enclosures, irrigation, etc., round about 4000 BC, which was the date I was given by the British Museum for those very early Cotswold long barrows. And I lived on a site, and so I was able to inspect and look at the many different layers of archaeology beneath the surface and realize that very clever people had brought agriculture to Britain. The trail led back, with the help of Christian O'Brien, to his discovery of a very bright group of people who were called archangels, angels, watchers, and even druids linked in there, who were the culture bearers who had brought civilization from the Near East from the very earliest times. And their trail goes around the world. And all the common stories we have of culture bearers and gods bringing wonderful gifts go back to a small group of people who clearly had survived a horrific cataclysm round about 10,800, 10,700, these two big spikes on the temperature record, where large chunks of supernova debris had come through our solar system, causing absolute chaos and giving us the floods and catastrophe of wipeout of many species, the biggest mass extinction for 3.5 million years, and the tipping of the Earth on its axis, which, of course, accounted for that. And to tip it on its axis, it needed a very large object they travel close by to provide the torque for the Earth to tip on its axis. Mm. So we have, in essence, a restart of civilization from the survivors, a small group of survivors of a previous very advanced civilization. And the latest on that is that we seem to have now evidence of another species of Cro-Magnon, a much larger Cro-Magnon species, who would have been living under a far denser atmosphere before our own atmosphere was largely stripped of a lot of it, round about this time of 10,700, 10,800 BC.
And just for people who obviously are going to ask this question now, what is he talking about here? Is he talking about spacemen coming from outer space, from this planet, from somewhere else? Maybe you can address that a little bit, and what your ideas or theories are about that, Edmund.
I think that so many people have got the Sitchin message, and many people, von Daniken, talk about spacemen. My view is that it's quite wrong to latch on to that particular thesis, because we have all the evidence we need of people on this planet having achieved a great deal over the last 50, 100,000 years, and that what we're looking at is a restart by people who are identical to us, virtually identical to us. They may have been totally identical to us. We are the products, and we are they are our ancestors. And everybody on the planet we can trace back to one single male Y chromosome round about 50,000 BC. So when we're looking at the Anunnaki, we're really talking about the Aryan people who were the progenitors of everybody on the planet. So we're really talking about a very close family unit, even though I've used this word Aryan, which meant noble ones, good ones. It was completely misused because Hitler took over this concept of Aryan purity, which was an absolute disgrace, and we know the whole story there.
Yes.
But I think that serious historians, in looking at the past, actually have to look very hard at this word Aryan, what it means, where it comes from, and how crucial and important it is to every one of us on the planet in terms of the culture bearers, the bringers of civilization, and totally benevolent people. Plato makes the point they were totally benevolent, so do many other people. And we must forget about spacemen, aliens, and nuclear wars, so many distortions which have been dreamed up by the conspiracy theory journalist. It's just really muddied the water so much. And most of us who seek the truth want to get back to a basic common sense message where we can see real people, real ancestors, and not mythological creatures or signs in the sky or whatever. We've got real people doing real things, and they are our ancestors, and they were very good people, and they acted in our interests.
Yes, so what you're talking about here is the people, this small group, as Christian and Barbara Joyeux-Byron called it, the genius of the few, that these few were basically a remnant of a previous civilization that had built up this knowledge for during many, we don't know, hundreds, possibly thousands of years, and consequently when the cataclysm occurred or happened, they set up shop, so to speak, in a new location and had this, consequently, this knowledge with them. I guess what we can expand on that, though, is that you also extrapolate on this idea that they actually genetically engineered us as human beings. Isn't that right, Edmund?
Well, if they were sufficiently advanced to bring a whole agricultural package of domesticated crops and animals to one place round about the same time, and with all the detailed texts written in the Sumerian Karsag epics, which are the oldest, they were originally described as the oldest religious documents, but of course they weren't religious. They were down-to-earth practical people doing practical things. And during the course of this interview, I hope I can lay some of the nonsense about temples and religion and us using today's ideas about what happened in the past. The concept of temple is evolved from Taimen or Taimon, which was a sacred area. Worship was originally the word workshop. And so our ancestors were very practical people who understood how to let their brains work. They had excellent diets, and they raised their consciousness to very high levels, what we should be trying to do now. And we're not looking at rather nasty fish-shaped serpent-type people who have evil intent. We're looking at absolutely first-class, noble people who had our best interests at heart and laid down the laws as early as 9,500 BC. And we see this coming through into the land of Canaan with the Canaanites and with the Sumerians and eventually the whole world under one system, which was the Indo-European system led by the Sumerians.
Do you think that these people are in some references described even in the Bible? I don't know if in that case they are attributed to being this evil race, but we hear about different versions about knowledge is something evil, the idea of good and evil, to have that knowledge, that's evil, and casting out the serpents of certain lands and things like this, that type of lingo, if you will. Do you think that could be a reference to this people, this ancient people?
We have a Hittite king who is said to have killed two of the Sumerian kings because they were evil serpents. And we have in the Greek records a very clear comments about the serpent knowledge being the ancient superior knowledge before the flood. And of course, the flood they were referring to was Noah's flood, which was a Sumerian flood round about 4,200 BC. But we're talking about going back another 5,000 years to the serpent knowledge. And the word serpent doesn't mean snake at all. It means wise person, wise man, wise woman. Absolutely crucial to get that point. The snake cults and the denigration of the serpents is something that came along when Mesopotamia and the Hittites and the Sumerians, when things began to fall apart at the what I call the end of the Golden Age, or the Golden Age that was destroyed by another crucial batch of cometary debris coming in and going bang and literally knocking large parts of the Middle East to China flat with the same kind of cometary debris which was had plagued the planet on and off for a very long period of time. So the old order was denigrated by people who wanted to set up their own ideas. And we see the Catholic Church doing exactly the same thing, claiming that St. Patrick went to Ireland to banish the serpents.
Yes.
When in reality, it was a serpent knowledge, and the serpent knowledge was the wisest knowledge, the wise ones, the many wise ones.
So this cometary debris that you're talking about as well, do you think that was something, there was some kind of catastrophe? We don't know maybe exactly what that was, if it was a planet that came in or what actually happened there. It's an intriguing story. There's many theories about this. Books has been written that is trying to unravel this mystery, as it were. But do you think that has been something cyclical that is coming back in at certain points throughout human history, or do you think that was a one-off event, so to speak?
No, I think it was the whole history of the planet and the solar system is of episodic cosmic catastrophes of various kinds. But the books that are very, very important is Earth Under Fire by Paul LaViolette and The Cycle of Cosmic Catastrophe by Richard Firestone and somebody called Warwick Smith and another gentleman. Marvelous works. And the other book I think people should look at too is Message from the Ancestors by John Gagnon. And that's available on my website under the Axis Shift section on the news item page. And those three books, in my opinion, give superb evidence of a massive supernova explosion or a similar event. It looks like a supernova explosion way out in our not in this galaxy but in the solar system as such, and large amounts of debris flying all over the place. But in the first instance it's a flash, and then there's a shock wave, and then the debris comes floating in, if you like, many thousands of years later. So the supernova explosion date was put at 39,000 BC, about 7,000 years later. You're getting the shock wave, and then much later, round about this date of 10,700, 10,800, you're getting some of the really large chunks of not just of rock, but close passes by of large objects, clouds of ice, clouds of supercooled nitrogen, all the kind of thing that planets are made of, blasted into our solar system and completely disrupting the passage and orbits of our planets within our own solar system. And the experts would provide you with the evidence of much upheaval there and many clues as to major problems. And at the same time, large chunks of our own atmosphere stripped off, maybe even the atmosphere of Mars completely removed at that time. But that is a little more speculative and needs a lot more research doing on it.
So do you think there's something to the story of, for instance, Tiamat coming in from the Babylonian Sumerian record about the mingling of the salt and the fresh water, you know, that we have potentially some kind of I don't know, mixing of ecosystems on this planet, and that the everything on our planet after this point actually is changed in some way. Do you think that that was the case?
Well, this is what Bernard Dallaire has done with Derek Allen in their book Cataclysm, which is really the fourth major read for people. They should read that book because I actually it's probably more comprehensive in so many ways. And it does do exactly, as you say, refer to Tiamat and Kingu and the Sumerian records, which were interpreted quite differently by Zechariah Sitchin. And Dallaire and Allen, I believe, have made a far better case to show that the Sumerians knew exactly what was happening. And their knowledge of observational astronomy and science was incredible. And here we can follow the trail back to Karsag, or head enclosure, as it was called, Garden of Eden. We can look back at very bright, clever people who had managed to survive and were able to bring all the tools and the seeds and the technology to start all over again and to spread that knowledge around the world, and also be incredibly aware of the threats and risk to this planet. And so when we get to the second major problem here, the big problem, at 2354 BC, natural catastrophes and Bronze Age civilizations is the book to get here, and you'll find that that catastrophe arrived. It wasn't as bad as the big one in 10,800, but the people at the time thought it would be another wipeout. So when you see what were in fact the Sumerian kings living in Upper Egypt at the time of the Old Kingdom, you find this massive building program underway with not to bury the dead, but to keep the live people alive. And that's why we find this building of a whole number of constructions, big structures underground, many tunnels, extraordinary mastabas, very sophisticated, and of course something like 80 pyramids built over a time span of 100 years, which coincided with the henges in Britain and dolmens and many other structures which were used for very accurate observational astronomy. They knew a big problem was coming. They took all the measures they could, particularly amongst that elite group which had moved from Sumer to Egypt. Mm. And in my opinion, there is no doubt that the purpose of the pyramids in Egypt, principal purpose, was for very valuable possessions to be preserved, people to be able to get under cover, the food and the resources there, so that they would have survived several months, if necessary, inside those structures or near those structures. That was a question of not making the same mistake as they'd made before, which was perhaps not being well enough prepared, which left us literally with a tiny group of people starting all over again.
Hmm. That's a very interesting idea, and that would mean that there probably or could be might be some more shafts or more temples, if you will, inside the pyramids that we haven't yet discovered then, because as far as I know, there aren't too much space or too much room, but maybe you're just talking about a very small group that was meant to lodge inside the pyramids, right?
Well, I think that you've got quite a variation. The Bosnian pyramid has large numbers of tunnels. We don't know what's inside it. There's a suggestion there's much more inside the Great Pyramid. But the Great Pyramid, to me, looks like an engineering marvel to preserve some of the most valuable artifacts of mankind in the worst possible conditions. If we look at many of the other pyramids, we find very large spaces inside where on wooden platforms, etc., an enormous number of people could have taken cover. Even in Mexico, with the Pyramid of the Sun, a massive chamber has been found right at the heart of that pyramid, which would have taken an awful lot of people undercover at the time when they expected the problems. Mm. And many of the Egyptian pyramids, if one actually looks at them, you find there are a whole number of features there which are interesting, like somewhere to store water at the bottom, somewhere to store food, places for people to go. But they were built to such incredibly high standards. With the Great Pyramid, for example, with this extraordinary hinged door halfway up, if you were going to design a perfect structure to withstand the kind of problems that were thrown at us, 3,354 in some parts of the world, and certainly complete catastrophe with the Earth moving on its axis, then a pyramid structure with the design features and associated rooms, chambers, etc., would have been absolutely ideal for the preservation of life. It's very unlikely these very practical, intelligent people would have built tombs, and we haven't a scrap of evidence that any one of them was built as a tomb. In fact, Snefru, I think, built three pyramids, and if you look at the family and the time span of 100 years, this whole spate of pyramid building has nothing to do with tombs whatsoever. It has to do with a practical problem of people who really understood advanced observational astronomy and had survived an earlier catastrophe and really thought it was going to be as bad again or could be as bad again.
So it's interesting that you bring up the Bosnian pyramids or what I like to call the Yugoslavian pyramids from the older Vinča culture, which seems to have some kind of relationship to other Indo-European cultures at that time. But do you think that they're genuine? There have been some questions about that, but what's your take on it?
Well, I've spent time with Sam Osmanovic and organized lectures for him. I've seen the report on the casing covering being of a very sophisticated form of concrete. I've looked at all the geopolymer research, and it's perfectly clear to me that the ancients understood geopolymers, and they used it in many different ways. They used vegetable acids for finishing off polishing stoneworks, etc. And we've got evidence of extraordinarily hard and long-lasting concrete on the Rio Tinto River, for example, on the wharves, which would have been used for ships to take the metals mined up the Rio Tinto River across the Atlantic or wherever. And so the Bosnian pyramids are a reality, whether you like it or not. We can argue about the date, and we may have more accurate information much later on. But clearly, we have this diffusion of agriculture, sophistication, and peoples from the Canaanites, from the land of Canaan, from the Hittites, the Sumerians, and this movement of the Pelagazi, the Carians, the Lydians, the Etruscans. We can see this whole spread of peoples from the Near East into the northern regions of Hungary, Romania, the Bosnia, etc. And so there's a lot more to discover. We're just scratching the surface of our incredible past, and we need to be open-minded and not have Egyptologists telling us we cannot look for a tunnel, we cannot test equipment, we cannot do anything to upset the status quo of all the knowledge they absolutely certain they know all about.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. Totally agree with you. Tell us a little bit more about, you mentioned at the beginning here about the CARSAG documents. Tell us a little bit more about these. When were they found, or are they part of some other scripture, or has this mainly been only this document, so to speak, that the CARSAG documents is something that have been found much in the same way as the Dead Sea Scrolls, or can we compare them in some way to that?
Well, the most important city in Sumeria from the administrative point of view was the city called Nippur. And Nippur was dedicated to Enlil and Ninkarsag, two key figures here at Karsag. Many of the cities were dedicated to one god or another. And I would remind everybody listening that even Hadrian, as recently as 146, I think it was, AD, had the Pantheon in Rome rebuilt in honor of these gods. And the Pantheon is an incredible building with a concrete domed roof where lots of light aggregate material like pumice from volcanoes was used. An incredible design. It's still standing today if you go and look at it, and it was dedicated to the gods. And so it wasn't so long ago that we understood that there were real live gods doing wonderful deeds, and they were the culture bearers, they were the real live people, our ancestors, who made everything possible for civilization or the restart of civilization. Now, in Sumer, they wrote history books, and they had incredible records. 90% of their records were extremely accurate, accounting, measuring, practical things which had to be perfect. They also, amongst that material, had a number of important documents. One of them was called the Enuma Elish, for example. The Genesis text is a copy of some of that Enuma Elish material. The Bible's put together from Sumerian records while the Hebrews were in exile. So go back to the original material and look at the Sumerian records. Now, what we had the good fortune of finding were clay tablets in the library at Nippur, which were discovered by the University of Pennsylvania in their expedition 97-98 to Nippur itself, which is about 60 miles southwest of Baghdad. And those tablets were taken back by the University of Pennsylvania team to Pennsylvania Museum and stood in the basement. Now, fortunately, they appeared to have got most of that collection together in one place, because what happened with so many of the tablets from Sumer was they were scattered around to different museums and libraries before they'd even properly catalogued them or even knew what they meant. And they still have this massive problem of translating the cuneiform, the wedge-shaped lines of cuneiform, which changed about seven times over a 2,000-year period, starting with a simple vertical picture sign, similar to ones you see on the Phaistos disc. Mm-hmm. And Christian O'Brien took on this task of translating the Karsag epics. And the first man to deal with it was the leading man of his time, Professor George Barton, at the University of Pennsylvania. And Barton thought or regarded these texts as incantations and hymns about Enlil and Ninkarsag. And what, of course, we've been able to do, or O'Brien was able to do with incredible interdisciplinary skills, was to be able to look again at that work, recognize it as Barton knew that it was the oldest religious text ever recovered, and that it needed to be translated in a secular manner, a secular way. And this is what O'Brien did. And we have a lovely story of country folk and people and watercourses and farming and cedar trees, an incredibly detailed account on 13 different tablets. Well, the one was a cylinder, others were single tablets. And this is all available to look at. It'll be on my website soon. And Lawrence Gardner has done a marvelous work on putting all the bits and pieces together, he found for me the original George Barton publication published in 1914 and demonstrates how much of those texts were translated by Christian O'Brien. And we're only looking at the last 20, 30 years actually to be able to translate this incredible story, incredible record. And O'Brien was able, as one of the world's leading exploration geologists, to find the site and a whole number of other clues from the books of Enoch and from the geology and from the descriptions of the ground and the land. He was able to identify this site close to Mount Hermon, 8 miles north of Mount Hermon and 25 miles west of Damascus. And so we have the site. You can look at it on my website. You can see the Google images of the Great Watercourse.
Yes.
And to sum it up very briefly, so I don't run on too much, the story really is from Genesis. And the Lord God planted a garden eastward in Eden. Now, this was east of where these people came from, in my mind, much earlier. And there he put the man whom he had formed. And out of the ground made the Lord God to grow every tree that is pleasant of sight and good for food. And a river, should read Great Watercourse or Watercourse, went out of Eden to water the garden, and from whence it was parted. Now, the translation there, clearly, you don't part rivers with anything much other than sluices, and became into four heads. Well, rivers don't go into four rivers. They go into four heads or four irrigation channels.
Yes.
And you have the names. And then, of course, there's a reference here to Goeth towards the east of Assyria. Well, Assyria was founded round about sort of 1700 BC, about 8,000 years after the event. And you can see these images on the website. And I hope that somebody out there will be listening and get in a car and or get a driver and drive down to Carsag and talk to the farmers and walk along the watercourse. And maybe you'll be the first person to have a lovely photograph of the sluices and to show us all very clearly that what is on the ground can be seen very clearly from the air is, in fact, the Garden of Eden site.
That's really, really interesting. I know that David Flynn, for one, also has done some really interesting work when it comes to Mount Hermon and the potential as the potential place, I should say, of the Watchers, you know, and so much in the same way we have this kind of mythological image, at least, of someone coming from the mountain areas, from the mountainous areas and down, you know, after some kind of catastrophe or something that has happened there. So there's more reference to this particular people around. And what you're saying here is that they basically built the Garden of Eden to maintain themselves and to well, for survival purpose, obviously, you know, to begin to plant seeds and to begin to do I guess also as well then genetic engineering and start to develop or what do you call it bring forward plants or food that would be appropriate for the people in that region. Isn't that right?
That's right. And what they picked was what would have been wonderfully fertile land, volcanic land, in the, just off on the edge of the Bekaa Valley, with all the water they needed for summer irrigation, which was crucial for this farming operation, for continuity. We've been to the site, we've taken photographs of the site, and you can see what a perfect site it is. It's the only place in the whole area where one even could have considered irrigation on a large scale. And then we hear about the cedar trees, the cedar forest, the enclosure, the keeper at the gate, all sorts of wonderful stories, how Gilgamesh and Enkidu went to the great cedar forest and slayed the giant and spoke to the keeper at the gate. And all these stories all dovetail in and fit in. And the more I spend on this subject and the more I read what other people are saying and doing, then I think that within quite a short period of time, we'll have a strong body of opinion that supports the basic O'Brien thesis. Now, the key, one of the keys here is this question of finding that there are 10 probable centers of origin. And sorry, that's my computer going bang, because I've put up the image here by Ron Pinhasi, Joachim Fort, Albert J. Ammerman, tracing the origin and spread of agriculture in Europe. Mm-hmm. And they've looked at 735 archaeological sites used in their analysis. And they've picked out what they regard as 10 probable centers of origin. And the actual sites they've got here is Sulacambus in Cyprus, Catalhoyuk, Kayanu, Abu Huraira, which isn't far from Göbekli Tepe, and I'll talk about that later, Kermes Deir, Ali Kosh, Aswad, which is very close to Damascus, Jericho, which is immensely important, and Abu Mahdi, which is way down on the Red Sea. And you've only got to take an average of those 10 probable centers of origin, and you end up round about this site of Damascus, or the Great Rift Valley that runs from literally from Turkey right down into Africa. But that fertile soil and the Rift Valley down to Jericho is immensely important, because at the time, 9,500 BC, that would have been a very warm, well-watered place for people to do experiments with farming. And of course, the Karsag site itself couldn't have been designed better for what was required at that time. And then we look at the domestication of a chickpea. The chickpea is a summer crop. It would dry up drought if it doesn't have water, therefore it has to be irrigated. We find the domestication of the fig, totally different from the wild fig, 9,300 at Gilgal II, which is very close to Jericho. So we can follow the trail now of all our original founder crops, and realize, too, that there was enormous difference between the wild, unpalatable seeds and these incredible crops that were produced, which are still as good today as they were then in terms of nutrition, etc.
Yeah.
And the specialists will tell you that could only have been done by extraordinary genetic modification skills, and that it was a one-stage operation. This idea that people propagated crops over 300 years thinking they might turn into something useful is absolute nonsense. And Lloyd Pye, on his own website, covers these points in great detail, in the same for domesticated animals. They're quite different from the wild animals. And in terms of nearly all the crops, it's now realized that it was a one-stage process. Hmm. The genes were taken out of the wild and altered, maybe externally altered, to switch on what was required and switch off what wasn't required. And this required maybe thousands of years of sophisticated knowledge prior to that time.
I do want to spend some time here talking about the upcoming Stars and Stones Forum before we round up for our first hour here, Edmund. But just briefly before that, what if you'd have free hands and let's say even unlimited funds, as it were, to go down to Karsag and do some kind of excavation there, or do geological mapping with radars to scan, what's beneath the surface. So what would you like to do, and what would you hope to find if you had those that available to you?
Well, we've done our preliminary survey of the site. We would have to get permission from the Druze people who live in that area, marvelous people. Their own traditions go back way beyond most other peoples in the area. We had a Druze guide with us, and I believe that we would, without too much difficulty, get local support. I've always wanted the Lebanese authorities to play a major role here, but they haven't even had the courtesy to reply to emails and requests, etc. All they want to do is ask me which institution I belong to, and I have to tell them that I've been trying to keep out of institutions all my life. And so the establishment, of course, has to write all its history books. The church and religions have to rewrite all their material. So when somebody comes along like me and says, look, you don't really know what's going on, I'm incredibly unpopular. You know, that was somebody once said that if you tell a lie, you're unpopular. But if you tell the truth, then you really are pushing your luck.
That's a good, it's such a shame. But hopefully you can just, tell them that you're from the Golden Age Project Institute.
That's right. I tell you what I have done. I have spoken to Edinburgh University and Professor Underhill, and I think that they can fly a helicopter over the site with a pod underneath, which will do X-ray and geomagnetic surveys. They've done a marvelous job discovering an ancient island off Greece. There's four islands there now. There were originally five before a big landslide. And so the technology is very straightforward. I just need somebody listening to this program to say, wow, let's put a little team together. We'll fly a helicopter over the site and do all the geophysical work, which can be done in a matter of days or weeks. And then we can start looking at where to put our cores, our drill our cores. And I think we'll find a completely preserved segment of soil, which has survived because when this site was destroyed by what they called a 1,000-year storm around about 6,400 BC, it would have preserved everything in a core, which can be looked at with the pollen seeds dated to very fine levels, and we can build a whole profile of what was happening, get a very clear idea of where the cedar forests were and went, and we can probably do a lot of bioarchaeology, which within a very short space of time would either say, yes, this was the Garden of Eden site, or no, it wasn't. So it needs to be done, and the sooner it can be done, the better. But you know, we're stretching everybody's limits by making this kind of claim, and it's up for everybody, I believe, who's interested to look at the facts, look at the information, go and visit the site if you want to, and let's all work together to get the truth about our past so that we can do what was originally intended, and that was to have people working together in harmony. And I believe that these people produced a wonderful system of city-states without politicians, without priests, and community action par excellence, and where everybody was able to have free will, which is the crucial thing, to bring the best out of each other and produce the over 200 trades and craft guilds, for example, in Mari and the upper Euphrates at 2,500 BC. And we actually have a wonderful track record and a wonderful history, and we don't need the conspiracy theorists and journalists to pick up fag ends and then try and produce sensational books about human sacrifice, etc.
Yeah, so that's a call to everyone who has the means and interest to look closer at CARSAG. Just contact Edmund through the website goldenageproject.org.uk, and hopefully something will come out of that. I certainly hope so. It's a very interesting area, and you know, my eyes just got opened to that area since we had you on the program first time in November, Edmund. So hopefully things will be. Something will happen, as it were, and work can be done on that particular site. But let's spend a little bit of time now, Edmund, just talking about the Stars and Stones Forum. We have about 15 or so minutes left here in the first segment, and maybe you can tell us briefly a bit about the forum or the conference, the event, what date and time it is, of course, and also about some of the speakers there.
Well, this is the fourth one which I've organized with John Agnew, who is our host at near Bury St. Edmunds in Suffolk. And we do a whole day of dowsing, and we have on that day of dowsing Stefan Cardinaux, who is a Swiss scientist and leading geobiologist, geomancer. We also have Konstantin Korotkov of St. Petersburg State University, State Technical University, and he's doing and dealing with this introduction to bioelectrography, a vital unseen energies around us. And this is all sharp end material about understanding dowsing and earth energies, etc., trying to sort out fact from fiction and using new technology to open up the doors. I think this is very, very important. There's a whole day of that and two lectures, one by Stefan and one by Constantine. Peter Kedrowan-Taylor is, in my opinion, one of the world's leading environmental scientists. He's been to two of our previous Stars and Stones forums, and he's going to give us, I believe, a world-class assessment of global cooling and the evidence relating to the impact of the coming galactic center alignment. And we've talked about this briefly before, and we'll deal with the detail of that in the second half of this session. Mm-hmm. Dan Winter, who is well known to many people as an extraordinarily bright man with science, a specialist in DNA, is introducing the neurotherapy breakthrough on human health, how waves conjure up factuality towards the end of addiction and the real science of bliss. And his website is Golden Mean Info. And neurotherapy is a new science in the States, which is all about balancing our brain waves, five basic brain waves, three segments of the brain, getting that in harmony, which many people believe can be done by meditation. Many people believe that this is what the ancients were doing to reach higher levels of consciousness. And we now know that if we get our brains balanced, our bodies heal themselves. The key thing for me is that we can heal addiction without drugs, and within a few hours we can remove the craving for whatever substance people are on, rehabilitate them in 4 weeks, and get them back into productive work from that time onwards after the four-week therapy, which really is involved in setting yourself targets, getting fit, having the right diet, and getting into a trade or profession or something that you want to do and can really get your teeth into and go to bed tired at night because you've enjoyed it so much.
Right.
We have Jess Taylor, who's doing an extraordinary pentagram in the Suffolk landscape. Joe Marchant, who's a science journalist, is going to give us this decoding of the Antikythera mechanism, which is this extraordinary computer found in the sea, and just to see how sophisticated that was. That's marvelous. On Sunday, we've got Vincent Bridges, who is a leading American historian and researcher, the story of John Dee and the Enochian angelic alphabet. Mm. Gary Bilcliffe is giving us a star performance. He's spoken before, and he's dealing with the Etruscan, the Pelagazi, and the early Egyptian connections on the incredible mephitic construction skills of our ancestors. We're finding similar technology to that seen in Peru all over the world, and Gary has been out on the ground and seen what the Etruscans were doing, the Pelagazi who preceded them, and he's going to be looking at, in detail, parts of the Abydos complex which haven't been seen before or aren't generally allowed for people to access. I'm doing a talk on the history of writing and language, following up on an international conference on the Phaistos disc, talking about the O'Brien translation of this vertical picture signs, which were turned on their sides. And to translate cuneiform, you have to start with these vertical picture signs to know what they are. And I should be talking about the Old Kingdom pyramids. I've given a bit of a preview on that and their purpose. And to wind the whole weekend up, we have Barry Dunford, who's a historical researcher from Scotland and author of a fantastic book called Vision of Albion, which I recommend. And this is the historical and spiritual destiny of the sacred British Isles. And what's so special about Barry's work is the sheer number of 15, 20 years research and work of incredible references to the fact that Britain housed this high culture, this high druidic culture, which was a refuge from all the problems of the Near East when the climate changed and the various problems. And the origins of Shambhala, according to Barry, are not in India, but they're in Scotland and taken to India. Mm. And that the Druid concept of way of doing things, it's not a religion, it was a way of doing things, a secular pursuit of knowledge, was the oldest religion and takes us, in my other work shows that we have very close links between the Druidic traditions, the people of the god An, the Tuatha De Nann, and Karsag itself with the Watchers and Angels who were the culture bearers. So all in one weekend, we've got a whole range of fantastic subjects, a lot of fun. It's only going to cost £35 each for 2 days. Friday's extra £20. A lovely rural location in Suffolk. So tell your friends and come along because we still have some places left. And this is the chance to combine a whole series of subjects which all link together, all network together to get this story of our past out into the open.
Where can people go to find tickets? Do you have a website set up?
Yes, if they go to the Stars and Stones forum.net or go to the goldenageproject.org.uk, then they'll find the telephone numbers and details of the estate office at Ruffham. In fact, I can give you the phone number now. It's 01359 270 524. That's UK, of course.
Yes.
And ring up Claire Davis and she'll look after you, find you some B&B accommodation, and come and have 4 or 5 days up in Suffolk and a nice Easter holiday.
So I will have these links, of course, up in relation to this program, and the phone number as well for everyone out there, for you guys who are interested in coming along and taking a look at some of these seems to be very interesting lectures here at the Stones and Stars forum. So Edmund, why don't we do like this? We can begin to round things up here for this hour. We can continue here talking, of course, more about Göbekli Tepe. I want to talk about some of the Peter Sedwan Taylor, his work, and the relationship between the magnetic field of the sun and the magnetic field of the earth, and how that potentially is going to affect our climate as the sun is heating up towards 2011, 2012, something like that. I want to talk a little bit more about Karzag, Mount Hermon, the Book of Enoch, and maybe we get into some more about the agriculture side and talk a little bit more about the Aryans as well. But I want to give your website out again, of course, Edmund, goldenageproject.org.uk. So head on over there, check out some of the articles, a lot of rare books and material for you there to dig into, as it were. So thank you very much, Edmund, for this first hour. Stay with us. We'll take a little break and then we'll be back.
Thank you.